It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 882 for the 17th of May, 2024. This week, ensuring that your computer is safe, private, and secure is easy enough, but doing so will make the computer virtually unusable. Let's consider some options that help without hindering, at least without hindering too much. In short circuits, Windows computers use the New Technology File System, NTFS, well, it was new in 1993, but it's not a good choice for devices that must also be used by macOS computers or Android devices. And thumbnail images shown on YouTube can help users decide whether they want to view the program, but all too often the thumbnails are little more than clickbait. There's a browser extension that can help. Every now and then, I think about privacy and security. Probably not as much as I should, but I do think about it. In fact, I know exactly how to make a computer absolutely secure and totally private. I also know that an absolutely secure and totally private computer would be entirely useless. These are the kinds of things that the U.S. State Department needs to think about. Imagine building an embassy in Moscow, where your building is surrounded by the FSB, the Federal Security Service. That's the modern-day equivalent of Vladimir Putin's KGB, the Committee for State Security. In the old days, the primary concerns were double agents, audio bugs, and service employees such as kitchen and custodial staff, some of whom were required to be citizens of the Soviet Union, or today, Russia. In 1991, a new U.S. embassy in Moscow was about half done. It was being built as required by the USSR by Russian workers. An inspection of the building revealed hundreds of listening devices that had been built in. And that was before computers had become a big thing. Much of the work had to be undone, and the entire project took 27 years to complete. The new U.S. embassy in Moscow opened in 2000, and it probably still wasn't really secure. Sometimes spies attacked simple technology such as typewriters. An article in the IEEE Spectrum magazine describes an event that was the main topic in the Spy in Moscow Station by Eric Hazeltine and General Michael V. Hayden, in which the Soviet Union bugged IBM Selectric typewriters. Here's a little bit from the article. After tens of thousands of fruitless x-rays, a technician noticed a small coil of wire inside the on-off switch of an IBM Selectric typewriter. Candy believed this was a coil acting as a step-down transformer to supply lower voltage to something within the typewriter. Eventually, he uncovered a series of modifications that had been concealed so expertly that they had previously defied detection. The primary point here is that if somebody really wants to obtain your data and they have the technical expertise to do it, they will. For technical expertise, think FBI, CIA, NSA, FSB, JIO, MI5, MI6, Mossad, the 610 office, or any of the hundreds of other security agencies all around the globe. So, what do you do if you want your computer to be really secure? Well, start by disconnecting it from any network. Intranet, local area network, and internet. Remove any network interface card from the computer. Remove any serial ports or any internal modem from the computer. Remove any parallel port from the computer. Remove any USB ports from the computer. Disable or remove Wi-Fi or Bluetooth adapters. Place the computer inside a windowless room at the center of an RF-shielded building. Place security cameras inside and outside the room, making certain that no camera shows what's on the monitor or what keys the user is pressing. Station guards outside the room. Allow only one user in the room at any given time. Log arrival and departure times, and prohibit users from taking anything into or out of the room. To avoid break-ins through the roof or tunneling under the floor, the room should be on a middle floor or several floors below ground. Floors, walls, the ceiling, and any doors should all be reinforced with 1/4-inch stainless steel. Okay, so now your computer is safe and secure, but at what cost? So you're probably not being sought by the FBI, CIA, NSA, FSB, JIO, MI5, NI6, or any of the others that I mentioned, and therefore less restrictive measures will probably make you reasonably safe. But even those measures will make the computer a little harder to use. As I said a while ago, I think about this occasionally. A computer protected in this way would be secure, but unusable. The law of diminishing returns becomes a factor, so the best approach for most of us is to choose a few security tactics that provide substantial returns and forget about the rest. For the computer to be useful, you will need to have access at least to the local network, the internet, disk drives, and printers. How willing are you to make your computer so hard to use that your data will be absolutely secure? Let's assume you have a printer, a network connection, and a Facebook account. You know that your Facebook posts should be shared only with your friends, but is that the setting you use? Yeah, neither do I. And although I try to be careful, I may have occasionally given permissions to a dodgy app on my phone. Privacy should be the default for websites and apps, but that's not what happens in real life. The European Union is pushing for more privacy and security. Google might eventually eliminate third-party cookies that track users across the web so advertisers won't be able to follow users from one site to another. Maybe. Don't hold your breath. Keep in mind that if something is free, you are the product. So long as the web is funded by advertising, you will be the product. So be careful. Beware. Use a password manager. Password managers do more than just manage passwords. They can help you create good passwords, and some have a service to let you know if your username has been involved in a data breach. Password reuse is a huge problem. Using the same email and password for more than one account is risky. If you've used your Facebook password for a bank account, you might find that your bank account has been emptied. Strong, unique passwords are essential for every significant account. But keeping track of all those passwords manually is all but impossible, so password managers do that for you. There are free password managers, but most of the paid services offer some additional capabilities for a modest fee. So passwords are important, but backup is the single most effective way to recover from a disaster. If a virus or a crook defeats any defense system you have in place, being able to restore files converts a disaster to an annoyance. Backup isn't magic. You won't be back to normal in 10 minutes after you discover a problem, but you will be able to recover. Difficult is a lot better than impossible. Several backup methods exist. You can create an image of the entire operating system. You can back up data to cloud-based services. You can copy essential files to external hard drives or locations such as Google Drive. Consistency is the key. My online backup constantly copies new and changed files, but there's also a local backup system that does the same with important active files. I create an image backup of the boot drive twice a week. All data files are also backed up each week to local drives. These are attached only during backup. So that's a belt and suspenders approach. You might find it amusing. You might find it silly. But I haven't lost a file in nearly 3 decades that I've been using a system like this. And along with good passwords, use 2-factor authentication whenever you can. If a scammer manages to obtain the username and password you use to log into your PayPal account, 2-factor authentication will safeguard the account. Probably. There are ways around 2-factor authentication, but using it makes the account much more secure. Many services now offer this feature, so enable it whenever you can. 2-factor authentication requires you to confirm your account with more than just a username and password. The password is something you know. It adds a third component, something you have. So, a scammer might have both parts of the something you know component, but it's much harder to gain access to the authentication code. Two-factor authentication means you might spend another 5 seconds logging in, but two-factor authentication alone massively improves security. Some password managers can perform the authentication function, so the extra time required is close to zero. The bottom line here is develop your own good enough security system. Understanding that perfect security is unworkable, implement security measures that address the most common severe threats. Making your computer secure may seem to get in the way, but security procedures don't need to make the computer a lot harder to use, and they do protect your data, your money, and your identity from thieves. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, your Windows computer has at least one disk drive that's formatted as NTFS, but some devices that'll be used with the computer should have a different format. The NT in NTFS stands for New Technology. It was new in 1993 when it was first used in Windows NT 3.1. The FS, of course, stands for file system. NTFS was designed for larger disk drives and supports functions needed by modern operating systems. When somebody builds a drive large enough to hold 16 exabytes of data, NTFS will handle it. What's more, individual files can be up to 1 exabyte. By the way, an exabyte is 1 million terabytes. That would be one gigantic file. And a drive like that can hold 16 million terabytes. That's all but unthinkable today. An earlier disk format, FAT32, FAT standing for File Allocation Table, not chubby, couldn't deal with files larger than 4 gigabytes. That was gigantic at the time. And the maximum disk partition size was just 2 terabytes. NTFS also handles journaling that tracks changes that haven't yet been written to the drive. This largely eliminates data loss if the drive unexpectedly loses power. Permissions similar to those used by Unix and Linux are supported by NTFS drives, and so is encryption. Volume Shadow Copy Services is an NTFS feature used by backup programs. It's used to back up files that are in use when the backup is running. Without VSS, those files could not be backed up. So all of that seems ideal, doesn't it? Why would you want to use a different file system? Well, here's one reason. NTFS doesn't work with macOS computers, some older Linux systems, or Android devices. So, if you have any thumb drives, external hard drives, or solid-state drives that need to be connected to non-Windows devices, you should use another format for them. You could still use the MS-DOS file allocation table system that persisted through Windows 3.1. That would be a very bad choice, though. Either FAT32 or XFAT, Extensible File Allocation Table, are the better choices, and XFAT is the best option because it supports the same drive and file sizes that NTFS does, and it's compatible with macOS computers, Linux systems, and Android devices. If you're sure a new device will never, ever be connected to another computer, choose NTFS because of its clear advantages. Otherwise, think about choosing FAT32 or Extensible FAT. When you open YouTube, you'll see a screen full of icons. Video producers often create title images instead of using a frame from their video. Sometimes these are helpful. But it seems that many are simply clickbait intended to drag you in. Well, here's some good news. There's a quick, easy way to get rid of clickbait. The Clickbait Remover for YouTube is available for Chrome-based browsers and for Firefox. As frequently happens, there seems not to be an option for Safari users. It's a free, lightweight extension that allows the user to decide whether to replace thumbnails provided by the video creator with the first or last frame from the video, replace it with a random frame from somewhere in the middle of the video, or just leave it alone. You can also control whether the title appears as the video producer created it, often in all caps, or switches to all lowercase or title case. Clickbait Remover for YouTube works everywhere on YouTube, including the homepage, trending page, subscription page, and all channel pages. If you dislike clickbait thumbnails, this is one way to get rid of them. I think it'd be helpful if the developer created an option that would allow the user to explicitly allow thumbnails on those channels that use them responsibly. That would substantially increase the plugin's complexity, and it is, after all, offered for free. One workaround for those who want to see thumbnails for channels that they're subscribed to would be to turn the extension off when you visit one of those channels. To obtain Clickbait Remover for YouTube in Firefox, visit the Add-ons page. For all Chrome-based browsers, use either the browser's extension finder or the Chrome Web Store. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.